Hello, everybody, and welcome again to Back to the Future, the podcast that showcases the innovators of today who are making the future happen. And making the future happen this week is Ugandan scientist and winner of our Futures 100 Innovators Award, Dr. Catherine Nakilembe. Catherine, you're very, very welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's such a great thrill to have you, because I know when we were trying to get in touch, it sounded like you were traveling pretty much to every part of the globe. So I was kind of going, wow, I finally managed to track you down at last.
Yes, it's been an incredibly busy few months. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, I did mention that you were a scientist, and I got to say, you're not any scientist, but you're actually the Africa Director of NASA Harvest. You're the Associate Professor at the University of Maryland's Department of Geographical Sciences, where you specialize in remote sensing and machine learning about helping farming communities in Uganda to future-proof food production. So I guess we're talking about drones here, data, and I think AI as a way to defend our food chains.
Absolutely. So the work that I do actually is, you know, initially started with leveraging existing satellite systems and satellite data sets. So NASA has invested a lot of money in advancing, you know, how we monitor our Earth. So we have these satellites going every day, and the European Space Agency as well as, you know, put a lot of missions in space. And that has opened up this explosion in terms of data sets that are publicly available, in addition to data sets that come from commercial satellite companies. And so we're in an era that I like to call as it's like a new era every few months, because the amount of data we're talking about is data that we were unable to download or process, even if we had a whole millennia, you know, 5 or 6, 7 years ago.
Wow.
But now we also have a lot of cloud computing infrastructure, and that has meant that we can pre-process and process the entire globe over a couple of days versus a couple of months. And so that has allowed us to be able to look in places that we wouldn't look at before, or we wouldn't look at them with the same cadence or the same motivations or same interests. And so you're looking at, you know, landscapes in Kenya, in Mali, you're looking at places that you would not be able to access if there's conflict or if there's an extreme event. And so the third part of this is, of course, AI, where there's an explosion in terms of approaches and methods for processing these massive data. So you can have the data, but if you can't process it to get insights out of it, it's completely useless. And so my work is sort of at that intersection. I also look into things like disaster assessment. So using drones for understanding the impact of, let's say, a landslide or understanding refugee settlements. But to be able to do that, you have to be able to process the data in really good ways. And so we do remote sensing data analysis. And my work is kind of spanned not only in Uganda. Actually, I started working primarily in Tanzania and, you know, worked in other countries, in Rwanda, in Mali, in Kenya, among others.
So I guess you have the data, you're capturing these snapshots of different landscapes. And as you say, it could be agricultural, it could be looking at refugee encampments, it could be looking at people migrations. But what is the end goal? Is it to use the data to create a better understanding of when these things can happen or how they happen, or perhaps to prevent or to anticipate future shifts that will allow you to react quickly, or rather maybe allow the United Nations or equivalent to react quickly to the things that you were telling them about?
So it's all those things. If there's going to be a flood, you know, getting a notification in an hour or 3 hours before, you could avoid whatever might happen. You might not drive in that direction if you knew there was going to be a flood, for example. But in the medium term would be that, is our infrastructure suitable for where we are? So you would start to address that going forward. To give an example, after the hurricane in New Orleans, you know, like places that were impacted, a lot of people, you know, have moved out of those neighborhoods because the risk is really high. Using these data, we can not only understand what is happening now, and if it has happened, how significantly a place has been impacted by the event. So if you're looking at damage assessment, if a flood happened, you have before and after images of buildings, you can assess the extent of damage. But also you can think forward, where if you've modeled and know for sure this is the extent of this, you can plan better.
So I guess once you have this, do you hand it over to third parties and then never quite know what happens after that point of data being handed over? Or are you directly involved with the opportunities that sit further ahead in the future?
So it's a little bit of both. The example of being involved in the process. So when I was working on my PhD, I was looking at drought and drought impacts in agriculture. And in that process, I understood how droughts happen in this particular area and the severity across space and time. And I had the opportunity to be involved in the design of a risk financing program, right? And so in this process, I was in the room where the design of this program was being developed that then translated into a response program. So if a drought happens, how early can we know and how do we get this sort of help that community would need in time? And so I would be able to analyze the data and give a forecast or give an indication of how bad things were across that area. And then in the other cases, of course, as an academic, you know, you do your research, you publish it and hope that people will read it. But more and more, being able to communicate what is hidden in academic manuscripts, I think, has become much, much more important in the time that we live in, because when people understand the meanings and the consequences of things, if it's communicated properly, I think there are huge opportunities for response, where if something is, you know, very scientific and overly complicated, you know, people might just miss the key messages. And so I do a lot of talking, you know, giving talks at conferences, among other things. And I find that I rarely talk as a scientist because I'm trying to usually distill and communicate things in the most basic possible way.
I have to say, this is how we came across you when we were looking at our Futures 100 innovators and looking at our long list. And we had so many different people who had mentioned your name, one of whom is a global vice president of global hardware at Google, Ivy Ross. He was saying, you know, that we have a lot of things happening, but what you need to do is to explain things clearly and well. That, you know, the thing has to be communicated in a language that people can understand and pick up on. And she said the second thing is, you know, when she was looking at your work, the mapping, the surveillance, and these pre-warning communities with these things, she said once she saw it, you could see how it would benefit other farming communities, both across Africa and globally. And she was saying that those two things together really make for a different sense of how innovation should work at its best. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on just what she was saying about the other opportunities that sit with your work on a global level.
I mean, obviously, she's a visionary and can kind of see, you know, the broader meaning of this. So from the academic research, you know, example that I was giving before, being able to get that knowledge into useful processes that can impact on lives is the sort of the thing that drove me more and more into figuring out how to work with communities. But then learning and figuring out what things can be scaled and applied in other landscapes that will be useful. So some of the initial work that I did, I can use the word transplanting, which is, of course, to diminish the value of it, is that there are these building blocks of things, meaning something readily accessible, something easily understandable in the context of an organization that needs to make decisions. This is the basic everywhere. And so having those building blocks and working with the organizations or the individuals whose there is their responsibility is sort of like what I've kind of focused on. So maybe not working on something completely brand new, but adapting something that has been proven and then scaling it. And so more recently, I've been focusing on developing a sort of a scalable pipeline that uses deep learning methods for extracting information. And, you know, we did it for one country, we did it for another country. And then we thought, well, this takes so much time to do it from beginning every single time. And so what we're focusing on a lot is thinking about optimizing the process and then as well as opening it up to others to contribute. So a lot of recent work on applications of machine learning, the data are open, the processes are open, the things are very well documented to allow others to take advantage of what we're learning and then utilize it. So
I guess one of the areas, and we have what I always think is quite an enlightened group of listeners for the podcast, that a lot of them will love their data. You know, they love their drones, very much focus on the future of AI. But some people will always ask, you know, with big data, with drones in the sky watching us, you know, the omnipotent presence of these things, as you know, as well as satellites, how do you ensure that the power which they can have sits firmly back with people? And, you know, whether it's the farmers, whether it's the scientists, the wider communities you work with, so that they are using these data sets and the data sets are not necessarily using them, to give you the sort of dark mirror version of how the future sometimes can be imagined by people.
Yeah, it's a reality of the world that we live in. And there's the, you know, I did talk about like our systems and processes being open, and, you know, we publish things, others can use them. And there's no way to guarantee that, you know, bad actors won't get their hands on it and do other all sorts of things with it. I think for me, my main emphasis has been, what is the organization that is responsible for addressing these fundamental problems that communities face? Like, who is in the best position to support the community? And, you know, even though in most cases, in some of the countries that I work, there's very limited capacity in terms of resources and financing, that doesn't mean that, you know, it can't be done. And so I've been working to try and utilize these opportunities that the data provide for us to see what is happening, to get them in their hands so that they're not always caught completely off guard. And, you know, the bad actors who might be able to afford to have the best computing, the best everything, don't use that knowledge without the awareness of people who can actually help. So to give maybe a more realistic example is, if you're looking at a place being impacted by a drought, one organization might see it as a business opportunity to bring in food from somewhere else and sell it at a really high price, right? But if that information is with an entity that is really seeking to ensure people don't suffer, then they would be like, well, there's going to be a drought. We need to purchase maize from where we can afford, bring it so that we can keep the price down, right? So if the bad actor has that same information and they bring their product to this region, the region would have a sufficient, you know, amount that, you know, the price spike won't happen.
Yeah, and I guess foreknowledge of why this benevolence, I should put that in inverted commas, is suddenly taking place. And I think one of the things that I was fascinated with just reading your story is, you know, we've had this kind of drone's eye view of your work. And I really just wanted to come back down to earth for a few moments to look at Catherine growing up. Because, you know, I'm fascinated. I come from Ireland. And, you know, my journey was not as brilliant and beautiful and different as yours. Mine was literally about moving from one small country to a slightly bigger one next door. But you set out in Kampala. And I think I read that your mum was an early rising restaurateur. So you have that side to you. Your dad was obsessed with taking things apart to see how they worked. And that was sort of giving me clues to the kind of character you potentially were going to build into. But can you just talk me through your early years first to give me a sense of how you set out on this particular journey?
So I don't think I set out on a particular journey. My upbringing is, I don't know how to describe it. I think sometimes it's just better to show it in pictures. People understand it a little bit better, because my upbringing and my current life are very, very different. So I grew up in Kampala. I grew up in Makindye, which is, I don't know if you've seen the movie Queen of Katwe. I just give as an example. So my life is not so different than the girl in that movie, except we probably lived in slightly better conditions. We're not in the swamp area, so we never experienced flooding, except where my school was. I remember we used to, when we're sitting in class, I know it's a podcast, but I'd show you, when it would rain, we'd have to raise our feet up so the rainwater would go under. And so it was very humble, I guess that's the way that it's put. But the thing that kind of kept me going was badminton. So with my sisters, we all played badminton, and this is like a huge defining factor in my childhood. So having grown up in a poor neighborhood in Makindye, which is one probably the poorest hills in Kampala, having this as something to go and do to keep me busy was really important. We had a community around badminton. We aspired to play tournaments, you know, we'd win trophies and stuff like that. So that was a huge part of me growing up. When I was in high school, they called me Catherine Badminton, Kathy Badminton.
I've got a note here that says Kathy Badminton. Yes, I was going to ask you, but you've anticipated my question.
So they would be like, you know, people at school, they would not know my real name. They'd be like Kathy Badminton because we did really, our team used to do really, really well. And so when I finished my high school, though, it's like when sort of things shifted. I thought I was going to do sports science. I've talked about this before as well, but I had this opportunity. It was really an opportunity in kind of a weird sense that I didn't qualify to go into the sports science program, but then I learned of this new program that I applied to and I qualified and you know, started going into environmental science. And then, you know, it was the time when I first, you know, worked for the computer in my high school. But then I started doing an extra course on computer IT that was being offered at the university. For some reason, I liked the idea of like technology computers. I was fascinated by computers. I think I was thinking about sports, but then the environment. So when I was finishing my undergrad, I wanted to do a field course because I grew up in Kampala. I'd never left the city for anything. And so I went out to the southwest of the country, to Windy, where the gorillas are. I did not see a gorilla. I couldn't actually afford to live there. It was just too expensive. And so my internship there did not work out. So I went all the way across the country. And I absolutely enjoyed my field work, which was basically I walked around with two game ranges in the mountain where it would rain out of nowhere, it would be freezing rain, it would be muddy with a GPS. And so I was able to bring, and then I was like kind of opened up my mind to, wow, being outside doing field work. And those things in the end, when I finished my undergrad, I applied to do a master's. I realized like there's just so much more to know. I wanted to be able to do environmental science. I wanted to do something around working with computers, and that comes together in what we call remote sensing and GIS. And then I got into the master's at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore.
You're making this journey sound really easy, and I'm just thinking about your mom and dad, who both seem to exhibit this entrepreneurial spirit on one hand, and on the other about taking things apart and rebuilding them and wondering how this works. And then suddenly you have this woman who's at Johns Hopkins. I mean, do you think there's any kind of relationship with your path in terms of these things that were predetermining it? Or to your point, was it something you just, as a lot of us do, you know, stumble ahead into the woods and the forest and then we go, wow, we look back and go, wow, that was a journey or a career. I mean, what do you think was really the defining moment that pushed you forward?
I definitely think that I did a lot of stumbling, but every single opportunity that I had, I really, really worked at it. Between high school and going to university, I worked at a gym. I taught myself how to teach aerobics. So I worked as soon as I graduated out of high school. Actually, it's my mom who told me that there's a radio announcement. They're looking for a gym instructor, and she thought that I could do it. So I called and I got the job and I went. So I did this like in the break between high school and university. And then in that process, I met a woman who was running an NGO for women and environment, who I worked for as well. I worked at a movie studio with my sister's friend, who is actually a famous musician in Uganda, and I worked on her movie project. And that allowed me to, you know, I worked with all these software tools, photo editing, video editing, and all of those things kind of like come together. So when I got into my PhD program at Maryland, one of my research assistantships was with this NASA Land Use Land Cover Change program, where all the people that you would cite in your research were like in the room in this meeting. And you're like, oh my God, like you would be in the room and all these people who are really influential for the field would be there. And that job that I had as a graduate assistant for the program, I would use my video editing skills, my photo editing skills, storytelling. You know, by default, you're a storyteller in the sense that you've experienced all of these things. And they have to kind of be communicated in a nice way. And so all of those things kind of then come together, like in my job as the Africa Program Director, is that I've learned highlighting people and their contribution to the work is so important. And I think, you know, a lot of people that I've worked with in East Africa or in West Africa, they're my friends. And also when we're talking about the value of the work, it becomes much, much stronger when it comes from them rather than from me. Because otherwise I could just be making up stuff, you know. I could say I've helped 20 million farmers. This is not a thing.
Yeah, I what fascinated me was because I listened to a lot of podcasts you did and read a lot of interviews you gave and actually watched you on kind of different segments on YouTube. And one of the things, and I think you're probably just saying this now, one of the things that really it just kind of excited me and fired me up was how your voice changed when you were talking about those things that for a lot of us at school were quite difficult. You know, if you're dyslexic, for example, which I only found out I was recently, things like maths used to puzzle me, computers, IT, and all of these things you were excited about and were describing, to your point, the magic of them through people, through impact, through drama and through the story. So your story didn't stop when you had done your work, which I think was one of the things I learned quickly from following what you did. It had a second act and a third act to what you were saying earlier, you know, how we identify the thing, then we look at modeling to see what could happen next, and then we go and see how we can make what happens next better and improve on it. So I just really felt that you had a better insight. I was really trying to work out what was this, the one thing that fires you every morning when you wake up. What's the one thing that just keeps you going, regardless of weather, technology, lack of funding, the bigger issues we have to think about with climate and sustainability? What's the single thing that kind of makes you go, wow, here I am?
I think there are phases. There are definitely phases of my life. So when I was working in Tanzania, what we're trying to do had not been done the way it was done. It was sort of like going against maybe how things typically operate, because I strongly believe that the people that we were working with would really find what we're developing really useful. And so I worked so hard to show them, in the sense that we're on the same side, we can make this useful for the work that you do. And then what ended up happening actually is just we became friends. Like we became friends and we just worked, you know, we look forward to meeting. Actually, that one of the ladies that I work with is retiring on her birthday in a few weeks, you know, maybe next week. And, you know, she sent me a message. You know, she was telling me she's retiring and she's wondering how my sons are doing. And she calls them her grandsons. And she was telling me what she's going to do next. And for me, this is so valuable. It's better than a grant, that like that relationship that I have with her and with others. But the place where I did my PhD, I remember one goal that I set for myself was, and I think I wrote it down in my personal statement when I was applying for my PhD, was that I wanted to do something that even if it could impact one person, change one person's life, like that would be for me a big, big positive. And so when I was doing field work, I ran into this boy who I know until now, him and his brother, they're like my kids now. And I remember when I ran into him and, you know, the conversation we had, and the next time I ran into him and then I started kind of continuing to communicate with him, he writes me letters and tells me what's going on. You know, we plan for his school, among other things. And I remember that the situation is he's in, I might have had a really hard life, but his life is 20,000 times harder. And when I got that opportunity to work on that program that I mentioned, where like the policy of the program was being designed, I was so, you know, it's like that moment where I was like, oh my God, everything that I've done prepared me to be here in this room to say A, B, C, D, because this program was being designed to focus on the region I was studying my PhD. They were trying to combine remote sensing, looking at agriculture, looking at food security. My PhD thesis was on land use drought and impacts on food security. And then they said this and I was like, oh, I, you know, like if I could, I would jump up on the table and be like, this is exactly what I've kind of been preparing for. I think that's one of the defining moments. And now it is, so I have twin boys that are five. And now at some point in my life, it's like trying to show them how to be kind and how to remain motivated and how to work hard. I think this is the thing that I learned from my parents. Like my dad would work on a car with no guarantee that he would be paid, but he would do it the best he can. So, yeah.
That's kind of trust and belief. I think those things hugely, you know, pay dividends in the long term, because I always think you know, a lot of areas that you work in, like you think about science, climate change, mapping, the whole issue of what's happening to our planet, all of these things are so uncertain and so precarious that in many ways we have to believe that there is a benefit outcome that will help others. Otherwise, we probably, you know, why bother going down that route? It seems to be disastrous anyway. So maybe with a positive view and a more optimistic outlook, we can change the future scenario that potentially everybody has seen as negative.
Yeah, I would say too, though, that I'm largely a pessimist, but an optimist. I do believe people can do their best and people mean well. I'm definitely an optimist and also a pessimist in the sense that the reason why I say I'm a pessimist is that I tend to over-prepare for the worst. But this is something that became a lot clearer to me after I had my sons and the fact that I used to travel with them for my work. I would prepare for every single possible thing that could go wrong. Everything from, you know, them puking three times on the plane, you'd have to have at least three changes of clothes. And so like that over preparation means that it's sometimes when I talk to like students who, you know, want to know like what's the secret, I say something like, usually it's like nobody can take away your knowledge. And so if you're prepared, like that moment that happened to me, like I was studying this, not to get a job, not to, like I was just focusing on understanding this problem. And then I had this opportunity for it to bring real meaning and impacting, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives, right? And this, it was amazing. And so being prepared is a part of me, but also hopeful that, you know, things will reveal themselves, like the truth, the path, the destiny continues to reveal itself, but you can't be like, I will wait.
Yeah. Or as you say, I think the fact that you're prepared means that I always think, you know, it's like being a Swiss Army knife, isn't it? You've got all of the tools and the influence. You may not need them all, but you know, when somebody calls on you to do something different, you've got them at hand. And that was really, I guess, my next question, because I'm thinking about Catherine now and then thinking about looking ahead into the future. What are the kind of challenges and red alert areas you see that you think you're now having to re-equip yourself to tackle over the next decade?
More and more I want to do, I'm going to use the word like deeper meaning type questions. So I want to really fundamentally, I did this a little bit in my PhD, understanding, you know, the whole problem, where it came from, the meaning of it, and how that translates into what we're seeing right now. So I want to do more of that. And, you know, we use this term as doing use-inspired research. I want to continue doing that. So doing research that feeds into a use case or a problem, trying to understand a problem, its cause, and how we ended up where we ended up. But I also want there to be more students, more young people who think about things that way, who want to contribute. I want to, you know, introduce more and more to technology and tools. And, you know, it's so many years since I was in primary school. For many kids, and particularly, you know, girls like me in Uganda or in other countries that don't have the opportunity to see what is possible and what is out there. And so I, at every opportunity, I want to sit down and talk and try to kind of show that it is sort of possible to achieve these things. And, you know, things might be really, really hard, but there is a pathway, and continuing to try to improve yourself is, you know, there's always something will reveal itself. So I'm continuing to improve myself, but want to work more with young people. And, you know, maybe in the future I will be able to work with other big people and do something much more impactful beyond an individual.
Well, I have to say, if from what you've described your work so far, that's pretty big and brilliant enough. I kind of feel that you've already set out markers that not only I think other people will want to follow, but I suspect you've laid enough breadcrumbs for them to be able to follow the trail well and quickly and brilliantly. And I think with that sort of openness and enthusiasm that, as I said, when I heard you speaking, I was going, oh my God, you know, I really needed to chat to you further to identify where this thing came from. We're slightly running out of time, and I just wanted to capture your last thoughts on, you know, if you had one big next plan or journey, and it was fantasy without budget or without controls or constraints placed on it, what do you think it would be?
I've thought about this thing. My brain's like my dad. My brain's always cooking up ideas, I think. But I've thought about doing what I call a STEAMS bus. So this is, you know, not something that's research. It is research. It's basically a science, technology, engineering, arts, math, but there's an S and sports. So I call it a STEAMS bus. And there are these like sort of custom made buses, which cost so much money. I've done some research on it, where you can go from like, you know, one place to another and have like mini clinics on drones and stuff like that. And I want to go to like rural schools and design like some projects to work with kids. One of the reasons for this is when we're working in Tanzania, we were going around with drones, and the only places we'd have somewhere to land is usually at a school that has a playing field. And I have these photographs. They're like the smiles on the kids' faces when, you know, we have to explain how the drone works. And they would be so, so, so excited. And I know that for sure that, you know, some of the kids that were there were really fascinated. And they were also fascinated by, because I was the only woman and I was like a girl, actually, you know, in comparison. And I want to do that bus, but I also want to do it with my sister, who she's the Uganda Badminton president. She's the president of the Badminton Association. And she's been doing like clinics and summer courses focusing on girls, but also creating opportunities through sports for kids to go to school, for example, getting them scholarships. So I kind of like want to merge these two things and try to do something like that. And I think it's not like a budget out of this world. You know, it doesn't need like $1 billion.
I think it's also great. It's a great vision because you think about that drone landing. I always think, you know, adults watching a drone landing spend the time thinking about, oh, how it's damaging this or it's intruding on that and potentially the other, where children watching the same thing are not just great believers in what it's doing, but also believe differently about what it could become. And I think that's that big difference that, you know, when you describe your bus, I'm going, great, interdisciplinary, about imagination.
And fun.
Yeah, and fun. And, you know, also not forgetting the physical side to these things, because we tend to, from the 19th century onwards, we've demerged everything into a specialism. And you realize that actually all knowledge and all spirit and body and mind should be thought as interdisciplinary and interconnected. So I'm going to leave you with that thought. And thank you again for joining us. It's Catherine Nekalembe, who was the winner of our first 2022 Futures 100 Innovators Award. Hopefully, I'm not going to ask you to say yes now, Catherine, that you would come and judge our second year. I won't ask you to do too many things, but it would be a great privilege if you could join us. And I'm afraid that's all we have time for. And you can find out more about Catherine's work and perhaps potentially to become a sponsor for the future STEAMS bus at catherinenekalembe.com. So until next time, this is Martin Raymond urging you to keep listening, keep looking, keep learning, and of course, keep asking what's new and what's next.